Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with The Positive Mind. T-Dub, what a sweet introduction. Bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more painfully free life. And we say painfully free because we want it to be positive, and part of what makes life positive is understanding people. And I tell you, today we've got a real case. Today we are bringing you a program about chronic pain, about people who suffer with chronic physical pain. What is that? And of all things to think about, you know, I would like to bring a pain specialist on, but I don't like their solutions. People with chronic and recurrent acute pain, like a migraine pain, lower back pain, neck pain, you know, the ones where it's really excruciating stuff, cancer, they often feel rejected by elements of society. You know, they feel left out. They feel rejected by the people who are supposed to serve them. You have this terrible pain and you go to your doctor and your doctor tells you what to do. And then the pain doesn't go away and you go back to the doctor, and the doctor, now you're now a sign of his failure or her failure. So they don't even want to see you. So they kind of keep you waiting. And because you have tried so hard and lived with this so long, you become frustrated, irritated, and you lose faith. Now, the healthcare system always promises you a cure, but it turns its back when it doesn't work. It turns its back on you when it doesn't work. So in addition to that, chronic pain sufferers begin to feel that they are being blamed by their physicians. You know, the physician says, well, you know, you can't, it's like, you know, you can't do this and then, you know, still expect that, so on and so forth. What made you walk in the rain? You know, you get blamed by physicians, you get blamed by your employers. You know, if you have chronic pain and you call your boss and you say, I just can't, I'm suffering. They eventually get so fed up with it that they begin to blame you for it. You get blamed by your mates. Your children get frustrated with you. Mommy can't go out because she's sick, you know, and they get angry at you. And other family members all seem to turn against you. Third-party payers, the insurance companies, they get really weird with you. They don't want to pay for your insurance, so they suggest that your pain is fabricated. They become suspicious of you. They become suspicious of your what may be a financial desire on your part. You want to rip them off somehow. You want to get pills from them and then take those pills and sell them on the street, which some people do. You know, or they may think you're going to want a claim for disability. They're suspicious of what you're saying. So now, on top of which, you have an insurance company, and your insurance company is now giving you a hard time. Your doctor gives you a hard time. Your mates give you a hard time. What happens? You get very distressed by this. So in the studio with me, Dr. Kent Robert Shore. Kent, welcome in. You deal a lot with people and their physical pain, don't you?
Yeah, I think my role of dealing with people that sometimes get on medications that are prescribed by their doctors because of the frustration that the doctor is feeling about the fact that the pain is not getting any better, and that they're really at a quandary to figure out why the pain is so problematic. And there's really, as you're saying, there's no cure. And for a lot of people, that's very surprising about the medical profession, where you think that you can go to a doctor and they're going to be able to find out a cure and relieve the disease that's causing the pain. But for the vast majority of people in chronic pain, there really isn't a simple answer. Migraines, chronic back pain, pelvic pain, all sorts of things like that, irritable bowel syndrome, and all these upper neck pains. These are all syndromes where they rule out a great deal of things we know causes that pain syndrome. They rule out cancer, let's say. They rule out certain, you know, abnormalities that we know. And they're left with a certain kind of pain syndrome and disease process that they don't quite understand what's going on.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Kent Robert Shore. We're talking about the person with chronic pain, and we're talking about it because it exists somewhere in your life, my friend. Either you in the future, you in the past, maybe somebody you know. Think about what happens now. This is what I wanted to ask you about, Kent. Somebody told me that the part of the problem, there are people who are in chronic pain that when they go to the physician, they cover it up and they act dignified and they say, yes, I have this extreme pain in my head at night. Now, if they present it to you that way, you give them one reaction. But if they come to you holding their heads with ice bags on both sides of their head, screaming in pain, and they say, oh, I have this horrible pain in my head, according to some of the research I've seen, there would be two different prescriptions. One you might give Darvon to, or you might give aspirin to, and the other one you might give a much more powerful drug to, according to the presentation, the way they present to you, the way they tell it to you. What should a person do if they feel extreme pain? Should they try to show it to you, the doctor, or should they cover it up and try to describe it less vividly?
Well, I think you're implying something which is the squeaky wheel gets the oil, meaning that if you're exactly. more and more showing the severity of your symptoms, that you're probably going to get a more empathic response by the physician as opposed to sort of talking about it detachedly. So I think that there's obviously something, you know, very helpful about being very open and very real and very vulnerable with a physician to let them know the severity of how much you are suffering. Now, with that said, what to then do, and again, what may be some of the focus of the show, is the person's frustration about the fact that there are, again, many symptoms and many syndromes around today in which the medical profession, really, they give it a label, they'll give it a syndrome, but they really quite don't know what exactly is causing these chronic pain syndromes. And let's be very clear, the medical profession is at a loss with how to treat a lot of these painful symptoms. And I think the medical profession has a hard time really admitting that we don't quite know what's going on. And we're quite unsure what exactly is the best thing to do to help their pain syndrome. Clearly, you alluded to something before, which is giving narcotics and giving opiates and giving strong medication like that will relieve people's pains.
But sometimes.
Sometimes. But to get chronically on opiates and narcotics, it can become problematic. And, you know, that.
And it's got a whole bunch of things to it as well, because once. So, again, what do? You go to your physician and you say to your physician, here's a presentation of my pain. This is exactly what I felt. I felt pain number 10. You know, one of the things I know about migraine people is they have a chart. And they bring the chart because, you know, the doctor is not prepared to deal with highly emotional people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you have the if a person is highly emotional, I think the physician tends to detach themselves somewhat. I got to pull back a little from this squeaky wheel here that's, you know, making all this noise. I got to pull back and try to see what's really going on. Because when somebody's crying and they're asking you for help and they're begging you for help, it must touch you emotionally as a physician, as somebody who's trying to treat that. You know, you must have to, you can't detach yourself so much, can you?
No, I think that there's a little bit, ironically, we may talk later about how people with chronic pains, at least from my perspective as an addiction psychiatrist, have sometimes get inappropriately escalating high doses of pain medication. But ironically, certainly initially, doctors and studies would show often initially undertreat pain syndromes because there's a certain worry or fear that somebody's going to get addicted to pain medication, let's say. Or, as you're implying, there's just a basic detach from the understanding and empathy of a patient. There was actually a very famous study where doctors were asked about themselves or someone they care about, let's say having root canal or some known horrible dental procedure, having a tooth extracted or root canal or cavity. And they said, if you or someone you care about was having this, what would be the appropriate pain medication during the surgery? And they correctly said, oh, a little bit of opiate, a little Tylenol with codeine, maybe a little Percocet for a day or two. 6 months later, the same physicians were asked, somebody walks in your office with the same root canal or the same tooth extraction, and doctors will say, oh, I would give them 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. So that study shows that actually doctors know the severity of pain some procedures entail, and if it were themselves or someone they care about, they would correctly give the amount of narcotic pain medication appropriate. But to strangers, they seem to, again, be overly concerned about making people addicts, or, as you're implying, perhaps a slight detachment from the person suffering, which is obviously really why a patient's in the office. It's the feeling of pain which is bringing many people to their doctors. It's not the disease process. It's the subjective feeling that I hurt somewhere.
Mm. This is Armand DeMille, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. We're talking about managing pain and just what physical pain is like. Kent, you say something very important here now. You say the physician will give the person a prescription that is less than what they know will be an effective dosage of something. And you say part of it is because they're afraid of creating an addiction. Do you think that they're afraid of that they just don't want to go through all the problems you have to go through in life nowadays when you have to explain giving a narcotic prescription to somebody? I mean, it's such a pain in the butt, isn't it? It's become over the last 10 years, we've gone from triplicate prescription mm-hmm. forms. What's it become? I mean,
well, right now, that physicians, every prescription,
yeah.
every prescription in New York is now being monitored by the state of New York. So they're trying to, I think in a good way, see if people are doctor shopping and getting multiple prescriptions from different doctors, which I think is something maybe we want to not have. But with that said, I think that the fact that doctors are being monitored with their prescriptions, they're overly concerned about giving appropriate pain medication, particularly with something acute, something that just happened, an injury or something like a procedure or the like, where no one would, you know, in their right mind would fault somebody for giving somebody some Tylenol or something like. I had my own experience, have my wisdom teeth taken out a year ago where, you know, they gave me Motrin and I couldn't sleep. I called the next day and the procedure was 2 days off and I said, this is ridiculous. You know, I couldn't sleep last night because of the pain, the ache keeping me up all night. This is, you need to prescribe me something appropriate until I have these wisdom teeth taken out.
Let's go back a minute now. You said the physician, there are people who go doctor shopping. Now, doctor shopping is somebody who wants pain medication or some other drug, and they go from doctor to doctor to see which one is going to give it to them, right?
Right. Or, you know, again, I guess we should really put it out there, our radio colleague, though on the other end of the political spectrum, you know, Rush Limbaugh, you know, that story of somebody in back pain getting a massive amount of narcotics from many different doctors. And that is what I was implying. Somebody who is getting lots of different.
So what do you do? I mean, now here's, I imagine the point is you can get as many prescriptions as you want and have them filled by all the different drugstores. Nobody checks anything unless you're going through insurance, right?
That's right.
So let's say you're not going through insurance and you want to get Percodans and whatever they cost, you know, $5 each or $3 each, whatever they cost, or the generic, which is, I'm sure, cheaper. The person goes to they go to a physician and they say, I need a painkiller. Do you have any signal about who it might be that's coming to you? Well, I guess you only give painkillers. Why do you give painkillers? Do you ever give painkillers?
Sure, sure. I think again, initially what I was saying, that a lot of doctors underprescribe often with acute pain, you know, when someone is suffering. Then we get, as with the show, people are in chronic pain, and they're in chronic pain, and because of the doctor's frustration about helping their pain, they give narcotics. Now, narcotics, opiates, things like Tylenol, Percocets, and the like, the problem with these medications is your body quickly becomes quite used to these medications. So that's one of the problems with giving pain medications like opiates for chronic pain. Chronic pain meaning some kind of syndrome that isn't getting any better.
There's an additional problem, which is they feel good. Right. You get a buzz from them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it helps with a lot of the things that I think we're going to talk about that can secondarily happen once people's pain syndromes start a life unto their own, where it's not just a pain that goes away in a day or a week or so. How people's depression, feeling of hopelessness, feeling of anger and frustration that the doctors aren't helping them, and a sense of powerlessness that nothing they're doing is helping their pain syndrome, and a certain catastrophic thinking that the pain is only going to get worse and worse. And those kinds of emotional and psychological overlay that people sometimes get once they're in chronic pain is kind of the ways that I think professionals like Armand and myself can be helpful and try to educate people that those kinds of worries, feelings of helplessness, frustration, impotent rage at their body and the people around them for not helping enough can sometimes fuel and amplify the amount of pain because of the overlay of anxiety, depression, and anger. Now, if you give somebody opiates, that will help as well. That's the problem. If you give more opiates, it'll cut through the anger, the anxiety, the depression, the lack of feeling that no one cares and no one feels my pain and I'm all alone and isolated. That's the problem with those narcotics. They're very yummy and they'll make everyone feel better, no matter if it's the pain is getting worse because of the process or all these emotional things that hopefully we can be helpful.
And there's never a steady dose of an opiate. There's no opiate that we know of that holds at a certain amount. If you're taking 200 milligrams of Percodan and that's keeping you going, or 20 milligrams, and that's keeping you going, it eventually just goes up and up and up, right? I don't know of an effective dose that stays an effective dose over a period of years with any sustained narcotic for any chronic pain, do you?
No, it tends to become, again, a tolerance is one of the properties of opiates. Tolerance means that over time, the same dose of a medication starts losing its effectiveness. Again, when you're on insulin for diabetes, when you're on high blood pressure medication for high blood pressure and all those other things, you can stay on the same dose. For those of you who have psychiatric disorders in general, the same 10 milligrams of Paxil or Prozac tends to work. That is often not the case with opiates and narcotics. The same dose over time, because the body becomes highly used to it and it stops losing some of its effectiveness. And the only way to get the effectiveness back is to go up on a dose. And that's why one reason, obviously, that Rush Limburg was taking, you know, handfuls of Percocets and the like.
And what happens also eventually with almost all of them is the body has a certain feedback loop. It looks at these narcotics and it says, hey, you know, we don't need certain things, and your immune system begins to shut down. And really, I think the body sees the introduction of opiates as a kind of a death preparation. Mm-hmm. When the body is flooded with opiates, the body is in effect saying, okay, let's get ready to die, and it turns off all of those health-generating parts of you. So here we are. Here you are with chronic pain. Here you are with the only relief being an opiate. And here we are saying, oh, yeah, but that opiate's no good for you. No, we're not saying it's not no good for you, but we're saying what happens is your body wants to shut down. Now, with a body that wants to shut down, you have an attitude and a psychology that wants to shut down. You don't want to see people anymore. You don't want to talk to your neighbors anymore. You don't want to go out on the streets anymore. You want to stay home, safe, where is exactly what the narcotic is telling you to do. Stay here and get more of this. In fact, you don't want to improve either, because your body becomes dependent on the drug. And the drug, very often, if you try to remove yourself from it, will exacerbate all your pains. It'll make all your pain come back twice as much. It'll call for you. It'll be making phone calls to your body and saying, you're hurting, you're hurting, you're hurting. Get the painkiller, get the painkiller. And for this, we have to look at people who get caught in this trap and say, oh my gosh, you poor folks. There you are, hiding out in the world. Hiding out in physical pain, not knowing what to do. And here we are saying, you know, at least there are at least two people who understand what it's like to live with acute pain. We understand it. Not like we understand it from the inside of having felt that level of acute pain, but from the outside. And having that kind of acute pain is an unbearable thing that you, some of you out there are living with right now. Isolated, not knowing what to do, you may even rid yourself of a lot of the opiates and be saying to yourself you're going to deal with it in a different way. A little later today, we hope to show you some of the methods we've learned for hopefully helping you with the level of the pain and how the pain, how you deal with the pain. But the first thing we're saying to you is we recognize that we are part of the community that rejects you, that treats you in a bad way because you're in pain and we feel powerless. I mean, that's the worst part of it. I feel powerless to help you.
Yeah, and I think, as you're implying, the medical profession similarly is trained to get a disorder and to be heroes and to cure and to get a hold of the disease and fix it with surgery or the proper medication. Medical doctors are very ill-equipped to understand chronic pain disorders. They really don't quite know what to do with it. And yes, these patients become very, very difficult. And these days, they tend to send them to pain doctors and pain management doctors. And many of these pain management doctors seem to believe that escalating doses of opiates is actually the treatment. There's a whole world of people, anesthesiologists that are pain management doctors, where my rough understanding of a lot of what they're saying about pain is that you just keep giving them increasing doses of narcotics until they're comfortable. That's really their psychological empathic understanding of the complexities of how a person feels pain and the way the anxiety, the anger, and the sadness and isolation will amplify people's pain. And there are obviously much more positive ways to address pain chronically than just more and more pain narcotics.
You know, it's a strange thing for us to both see because I've seen the very same thing. The anesthesiologist who becomes the pain specialist. You know, I mean, Kent, sometimes somebody will come to me with prescriptions. You know, they'll come to me with prescriptions that they got. You know, I got 500 Percodan from my pain doctor. And what do you – let me call him up.
Right.
Let me speak to you. It's an anesthesiologist. It's always an anesthesiologist. I guess they want to anesthesize you.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's their job. I'm going to put you to sleep.
Yeah. And I think that me as a psychiatrist, must own some responsibility because I'm saying that I believe that the brain, the mind, whether the mind is positive or negative as it relates to my feeling of a victim, my feeling of frustration that no one cares and no one's interested, and my perhaps negative view that it's only going to get worse and worse, that these very powerful psychological components to pain are things that you would think people in psychiatry and psychologists would be very interested in dealing with. And I think the reason why anesthesiologists took over pain management is no one in medicine, including psychiatrists, wanted to deal with pain patients because they're so frustrating and make us feel so impotent because it's so difficult to treat. And there's ultimately sometimes no magical, simple cure with chronic pain.
Yeah, I've had the feeling, and I don't know about you, Kent, that I've wanted to take some of them to task. I've given some calls occasionally and saying, what are you doing? You know, I know you and I have had someone in common who went to a pain doctor for sleep medication and wound up getting some kind of a drug that was, took an addict, somebody who was an ex-addict, right, and put him right back on the addictive cycle. I mean, do you ever speak to these people who make these prescriptions? Do you ever challenge them?
Oh, yeah. But, yes, absolutely.
I mean, you'll call them up and say, what are you doing?
Yeah, I'll definitely call them up and say, I'm not sure what your thinking is on what's going on and what's the etiology of this pain. You know, you're a fellow physician, so what do you think the disorder is? What is the disease that's causing this pain? And what is your treatment plan other than keep giving more and more narcotics, which I, you know, again, we can make narcotics legal and put them in Duane Reade if that's the simple idea, which is when you're in pain and the pain medication doesn't work anymore, then take more pain medications. Why do you have an MD? Why are you trained in the treatment of illness? And why don't we just have it over the counter if that's the simple view, that if someone's in pain and it starts pooping out, give them more?
But I thought all physicians were like an old boys club, you know, old boys club. That, you know, you guys don't challenge each other. You mean you actually will challenge somebody and say to him, what the hell are you doing? I mean, you may not say it in those words.
No, I say them in those words, but I guess I'm a bit of a rebel, as some of you radio listeners probably know. Yeah, I think this goes against some of the idea that we should cover each other's back and be united in terms of covering up for our colleagues, maybe, you know, not being as thorough with trying to figure out what's going on, and perhaps, again, trying to get someone the best care possible. Again, if you're coming from the field of anesthesiology and what you know is medication is the treatment of pain when I put someone under surgery and it's narcotics or something like that, then that they're coming from that viewpoint. Armand and myself and people who are more psychologically minded, I think, see the incredible powerful effect that the mind has, can be that a negative force in people's lives that cause emotional and, I would argue, amplify physical suffering, as well as the mind can be a beautiful positive part to cause positivity emotionally. And hopefully we'll get into the next part of the program. We'll talk about how the brain actually can be a positive part in terms of helping chronic pain.
So sometimes you have to challenge, and sometimes having someone like you, Kent, call up the pain doctor to say, well, would you please explain yourself, puts them on notice that someone's watching. And then you know what happens? They can't find appointments for the clients anymore. You know, see, then they get rid of the clients.
Yeah, I think that
they become accountable and they say, oh, this one's going to be a problem. Let me go get somebody else who's nice and innocent.
Yeah, again, having gone to medical school and obviously being a therapist, I got trained in the body. So, again, I would assume most people in the audience, they're like when I take my stereo to a mechanic, you know, or my car to a mechanic. You know, somebody could tell me my Flubelmeister is got corroded, and I'll just nod my head and say, sure, whatever. I put this cream on it, and it's $500. Thank you very much. And I would assume that's where a lot of people are with their pain syndromes. You go to a doctor, you assume the doctor understands what's going on. When they're giving you a label that it's some well-recognized sort of disorder or sort of disease that everyone agrees upon, whereas some of the things that doctors will tell people are, if they were more honest, they would say, we really don't know why your stomach hurts so much, or we don't know why your body aches all over, rather than sort of put it what I would think is in a kind of wastebasket of saying, oh, well, you have irritable bowel disorder, or you have fibromyalgia, or you have these sorts of things which are very complicated. It's very unclear what those diagnoses that I just mentioned really are. They're really the syndromes that doctors call when we have a slew of symptoms that people have, and we've ruled out a lot of known things like rheumatoid arthritis in terms of chronic pain in the joints, or ulcers or things like that with the stomach. We rule those out with the appropriate tests, and then we tell people, oh, this is what you have.
It is Dr. Kent Robert Shaw with me with The Positive Mind here at WBAI 99.5 FM, Armand DeMille. We're going to take a short break. We're going to lighten the spirit a little with a little exceptional Yule time music. Different stuff. But it is just about 1:29 and 20 seconds here at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. When we come back, we're going to be taking your calls, and you could send email questions to Armand at thepositivemind.com. And we'll try to respond to those as well. So if you're sitting near a computer or listening on a computer and you want to say hello, send it in by armand@thepositivemind.com. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Here's our old friend, Brent Lewis. Armand DeMille back with you with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. So having chronic physical pain, which is what our subject is, leads to a number of syndromes that go along with it. Keep in mind, distrust is just natural, right? How could you trust anybody? And then beyond distrust, you wind up with being criticized, feeling isolated. You know, I know people who have plans for New Year's Eve, and the thought is, I have plans for New Year's Eve if I don't get a pain, if I'm not suffering in pain, because they have to deal with pain all the time. There always has to be a plan B. But there's an interesting thing about people with chronic pain, Kent, and that is that they don't have a plan B. It's almost like they live hoping that it won't attack them. The ones who've got episodic acute pains, things like migraine headaches. You know, they live with them, and then they, you know, you would imagine they would say, and if I get a migraine, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a trip to Europe, and if I get a migraine, here's how I'll treat it in Europe. No, it's just I hope I won't get a migraine, and I'll take my medication with me. But it's nothing like what will happen if I'm driving and I get this pain. How will I drive back? Plan B is not there very often with people with chronic pain. And I think this tells us something about it. It tells us something about the syndrome, that the chronic pain syndrome doesn't allow you to project, to really accept it, to accept it as part of your life with some kind of a belief that it's a part of you and you're going to live with it, you know? So let's take a look at that part first. What are the other psychological problems that come along with having chronic pain?
Well, I think that it's, you know, having some kind of plan and planning for things is a very different way of coping than what is a common way that people cope, which actually intensifies and worsens the whole psychological and physical, you know, mind-body kind of downer that people are in, which is anxiety and fear. So the anxiety and fear aspect of it, you know, will this worsen? will I ever get better? Will the pain ever go away? Will the pain get worse? Is whatever is causing this pain going to kill me? All those kinds of anxieties and fears are a very natural way, and I guess a very human way, to deal with the frustrations and hopelessness that sometimes people feel that they're not getting the relief from their physicians and their friends about what's causing their discomfort, and they're unclear about what tomorrow and the future brings. But certainly, that kind of anxiety and fear is really causing the nervous system to get revved up. It's causing cortisol to be released. It's causing adrenaline to be released. And all those things we know are not helpful to the pain that someone has. If anything, people need to have as much as possible a sort of plan about future pain, but with that, hopefully, a sense that there's no need to worry, there's no cause for worry, and that worrying is not going to help their pain and help their medical syndrome. That, again, fear and worry is not going to be anything productive in terms of dealing with their pain. Now, obviously, sometimes people go to doctors and not only get narcotics and pain medication because of this anxiety, they start to get tranquilizers. They start to get things like Klonopin, and they start getting things like Xanax. And they come to me and say, well, my pain gets better when I take Klonopin and Xanax. And I'm like, well, that's again another Band-Aid, another magical instant relief for the worry about your pain. Can't we address that worrying, that negative mind, that negative mindset in a healthier way than just adding a tranquilizer?
Adding another drug to it. The plan, and this is, I think, a very important thing, the plan for chronic pain can be the job of the mate or the child who's with the person who's got the chronic pain. There should be a plan, and it should be, if this strikes, here's what we're going to do. And you're going to find resistance to it, because here's the way it works. When pain hits, the only thought is, I'm going to take pain, and if it doesn't go away from the amount of medication I take, I'm going to take more of that medication. Then I'm going to take more of that medication. It's almost like the medication itself is waiting to be had. So I think there should be a plan. Yes, after a half hour of taking 50 milligrams, we're going to wait for 45 minutes. And the actual plan, and you'd be amazed at how few people devise a plan and live by the plan. Oh, here's a sheet of paper that says exactly what we're going to do. And here it is now. So number one, making a plan is starting to make a break in the cycle. You know, and watching and seeing that medications certainly are not the answers. Now, what's some of the cognitive behavioral approach that people have used to managing and dealing with actually decreasing the physical pain using psychological process?
Well, I think when you're talking about migraines, which is, again, a kind of episodic, meaning that, you know, that it comes and goes, is a different kind of pain than certainly the kind of pain that's been shown to be very helpful with cognitive behavioral, which is the chronic pain that many of the audience will know from neck, back, pelvic, stomach, and the like, or people with chronic tension headaches. And those people are often in a very, you know, desperate place of feeling despair, hopelessness, catastrophizing about their ability to feel better. And also, they're in a place in their chronic pain, which is paradoxically, you know, thinking about their body as it relates to the pain different than what we know about acute pain. If you have acute pain, if your arm hurts or if your back hurts, if it's broken, you're supposed to rest that broken bone, or it's if it's injured. So acute pain, often the treatment is to rest it. What we know about chronic back and chronic joint and neck pain is that resting and atrophying of the muscles is not what is helpful at that point. So along with having a positive, empowering view that your pain can be conquered, that you're going to be able to, function with the pain, and that you're going to fight through the pain, and the pain is not indicative of something that's going to get worse and worse and worse, to deal with the negativity, the depression, and the anxiety, we also know that working some of the muscles and the parts of the body that are in pain when it's chronic pain is actually quite helpful. That the last thing you want to do is to have a part of your body, particularly your neck and your back, start to get weak and to get tight from lack of exercise, as well as some gentle stretching and loosening of all those muscle fibers around the area that may have a disc, that may have a spur, that may have some of these medical bony structures, but is amplified by the negative thought process that is amplifying the pain, as well as the passivity and the fear that if I should use the muscles around the pain, it's going to make it worse. And every study would show that's, in fact, the opposite of what is true.
What you don't want is you don't want the pain, you don't want the muscles to lock up. So you're stretching them. You know, a lot of people don't know what stretching muscles is, Kent. Mm-hmm. And I think that for that, let me recommend, there are a couple of books on stretching that are available at Amazon. I forget what the name of that beautiful one is that I have, but it's on stretching. And it teaches you different stretches you could do for different parts of the body. And it's something it says stretches that you could do while you're sitting down anywhere, you know. And it seems that by stretching those muscles for anything related to muscle pain, you will be bringing help to it. So that's a good beginning. Here's a question from a listener. For a few years now, I've found myself taking Percocet for spinal base bone spurs and have turned into herniated discs. I have done everything imaginable to manage this pain without drugs, but now I find myself unable to get to sleep without them. I've also fought bouts of depression since I was a child, and I find that these drugs help this too, which is basically what drives me to take them. And this is, she asks, any advice?
Well, again, the two things that we're talking about, which is, again, we haven't talked about the idea that there's what we call a gate theory of pain.
Let's talk about the gate theory of pain.
The gate theory of pain means that there's enormous number of neurons, brain tissue, brain cells that contribute to the perception of pain. So whatever pain is being caused by a part of your body, the brain has an enormously powerful influence to either amplify the pain, make worse, or de-amplify to minimize the severity of the pain. And so things like depression and anxiety and frustration, the three bugaboos we're talking about that can complicate the physical pain that you're in, are sending nerve fibers down the spinal cord to the part of your body, making the pain worse, amplifying the pain. And what you want to do, so the gate theory means that there are many fibers, nerve fibers involved with pain than just a simple nerve fiber that's getting the pain signal from the part of your body that hurts. And what you want to do is to treat the depression or treat the anxiety, hopefully, for some people, if need be, if therapy is something you can't get to. Sometimes some antidepressants have been shown to be quite helpful. So this person who emailed in about their depression and their pain, it's sometimes very hard to see what is the chicken and what is the egg, you know, in terms of the depression amplifying the pain. But now the person's in pain, as Armand says, they're now isolated, they're feeling victimized, they're feeling not understood.
I can't get to sleep without him.
Right, and now my pain is being amplified. And sometimes a very light dose of an antidepressant like Elavil or something like that can really help the sleep and minimize the brain's input that is amplifying the pain.
Now, but Kent, though, if a person, Percocet, Oxycontin, all of those are very distinct kind of drugs, and they they challenge anybody who tries to remove them. In other words, they themselves, I mean, we don't think of them as very strong drugs, but it's like cocaine, heroin. You try to get off them, they're going to challenge it. So if a person has this kind of question about themselves, I'm living on 20, 30 milligrams of Percocet a day, if they tried to go to a physician, they would be afraid the physician's going to take it away. If they came to you for help with this, you know, the fear is, oh, he's not going to let me take these anymore. And the drug itself is going to speak to you.
Right.
Once you get on every night, when you get every night that you take Percocet, and if it helps you sleep, every dream, every bit of your unconscious is now regulated by the Percocet, you know, by the opiates.
Yeah. I think that what I try to do, for example, would be this person who wrote to us about the fact that they're having sleeping problems and chronic pain with these bone spurs in their spine. The first question would be, have they tried a low dose of an antidepressant to help the sleep / to cause the brain not to amplify their legitimate pain in their back by depressive, anxious thoughts or psychotherapy? Secondly, this person is really getting to what I just mentioned before. Is this person, despite being in pain, understanding that lying around and not sort of addressing their pain by going for walks, for gently exercising, and gently stretching? Now, again, notice I used the word gentle, because that's one of the keys here, because this is a classic, you know, Papa Bear, Mama Bear, meaning what? No activity, no stretching, no exercise is very bad for lower back pain. But you also don't want to just go to an aggressive physical therapist or have your cousin who's a marathon runner pull you out and say, let's go for, you know, a 3-mile power walk. That's going to irritate things.
Even chiropractic can do terrible damage to you when you're trying to deal with back pain. I've had that happen to me many times, you know?
Yeah, it's a real art.
They can give you, you know, immediate relief because they release some endorphins, but a half hour later you're just as crippled.
Yeah, I think, again, if those in the audience who have pain and hopefully feel a little empowered by this about their thought process as well as the overwhelming evidence that a degree of stretching and strengthening of those muscles in the back can start reversing a kind of physical process that's going on there that's worsening that area. Because, again, if those muscles get weak and those muscles get flabby, they're then going to cause whatever bone or disc that's there to be more and more problematic. So, again, a paradoxical strengthening of the muscles will cause the areas of the joints in the back to become stronger and to keep those muscles loose and relaxed. And that's, a gentle process of slowly stretch, you know, doing some kind of stretching regimen that's very gentle and some kind of light exercise, whatever it is, start off, you know, walk around the block, because I think some people in the audience literally are bedbound and they're literally not exercising at all because they have the false belief system that when I do something, it makes my pain worse, which may be true on a short run, but it doesn't mean that it's making the process worse. It may be that there may be a little bit, there's no pain, you know, no gain if there's no pain, meaning that a slight degree of muscle discomfort to get a muscle that's been atrophied and lying in because of depression and worries about worsening my joints or worsening the disc needs a little bit of a gentle push.
You know, a lot of people wind up with the telling everybody to fetch for them. You know, you get in pain and you start saying to people, would you get this for me? Would you get that for me? Would you get this for me? Would you get that for me? And in a way, even though you want to help them out because they're in pain, sometimes it's a disservice. Because just being able to get things for yourself sometimes kicks you out of the room, kicks you out of the space. So there's a dependency that happens when you have chronic pain. And you wind up being dependent on people in a certain kind of way. But then an additional thing happens. You become dependent on the pain. You have a relationship with your pain. Now, this is a funny thing that happens. You and the pain negotiate. You start saying to the pain, please don't hurt so much. And the pain says, okay, lay still. And then you say to the pain, you know, please go away. And it says, all right, well, give me some drugs. And you have this relationship that it's hard to understand, and it's hard for people to understand that people who are in chronic pain have a relationship with the pain itself.
Right. And I think when we start talking about this, Armand, again, we're not saying that people are making this pain up, they're worsening the pain or anything like that.
Real.
It's absolutely real. Their pain is real. But Armand is talking about something very complicated, which people need to think about. Again, for those in the audience with chronic pain, did you ever notice when you were a child that you got the most love, the most attention, the most involvement with a parent that perhaps could be critical or be a little cold when you were sick, when you were in pain?
Or the only.
The only.
If not the most, the only.
Right. That can be a very powerful sort of unconscious thought process in your head, which is when I'm sick and in pain, I actually get something that I desperately want, which is involvement and somebody to care about me and someone to be with me. And for many people, you know, that could be one of the very complicated unconscious processes that they have to fight out of getting something out of their pain that's, you know, getting some degree of warmth or love or involvement that nobody really wants from their pain. They want because they're lovable or because they're admirable or that they respect. But in some households, when love and respect is in short supply, not empathy, but pity and caretaking is what you'll grasp at, because that's the only thing that got that kind of involvement from a parent who seems uninterested or unwilling to give what you really need.
And there are many people out there as well who are living alone in physical pain, and they're in this chronic physical pain, and what they do is they live it alone, they take their drugs, they stay in bed, they watch television, they maybe have a dog or a cat that they could pet, and this is it, this is the extent of their lives. And what we're saying is that leads to a number of things like depression and anxiety and psychophysiological disorders of other kinds, as well as substance abuse. All of that leads to something. It becomes a syndrome. The syndrome gets bigger and bigger. And what we're saying is if you have physical pain, do not settle for just laying around. Let us try to show you, let us help you look at some of your psychology that may be in the way. There are some behavioral methods that help significantly with changing people. And let's review the medication. Let's make sure you don't start self-medicating. I mean, I don't blame people for self-medicating, because the physicians certainly don't know what they're doing a lot of the time. But have somebody around who you could check with.
Yeah, I think all those things you mentioned, those kind of processes that sometimes go with chronic pain, again, anxiety, feelings of helplessness, feelings of frustration that I'm not getting better. Ironically, opiates, narcotics, remember the opium eaters from 2,000 years ago. Opium is a form of like heroin. It makes physical pain get better, but all those emotional pains also get better with opiates. So when people feel, oh, I'm feeling better when my doctor increased my Percocets from 6 to 8, I'm not surprised, because it, in fact, helps all those profound emotional and psychological overlays of the physical pain. That's what's so dangerous. That's what's so appealing about it. That's why I think anesthesiologists and pain doctors, again, it's much too complicated to kind of figure this out. Let's just increase their dose, or start them on OxyContin, or give them, 80 milligrams of OxyContin.
OxyContin is just coming back now after having been banned from the market. It's just been put back on the market, and I'm sure it's going to be floating all over the place. Which are these time-released Percocets, you know, that you could just stay glassy-eyed. You know?
Yeah, and I think just as a substance abuse person and the nerd that I am about substance abuse, people need to know that the amount of OxyContins and Percocets that are liberally given to people in these households that their 15 and 16 and 17-year-old son and daughters snooping around in their cabinets find is mind-bending. And our society has got to be very wary of the fact that these pain medications are in a lot of cabinets, and there are a lot of children curious about these meds and are making their way into their cabinets, and there's lots of evidence that a lot of adolescents are taking their parents' pain medication.
Yeah. This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Ken Robichaud. Ken, I want to thank you very much for being here today. I know you've got to dash back to your practice.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Bring your Dexter Gordon singing Someone to Watch Over Me. Very appropriate. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. If you want to send some questions to the program, send them to armand@thepositivemind.com. Back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. You can replay this entire program by going to the website of wbai.org.